House Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2570.
Mr. Chair, committee members, to refresh your memory, House Bill 2570 adds a new member to the OHSU Board of Directors that represents universities' collective bargaining units. We had a hearing on this on February 20th. You have in front of you a -2 amendment, which changes the focus of the bill. The amendment reduces the number of members restores it back to 10 members, which is the current makeup. It clarifies that in assisting the governor appointing a member with experience in representing the interests of employees, the two largest collective bargaining units, which would be AFSCME and the Oregon Nurse Association, would submit a list to at least three nominees to the governor for consideration. It changes the modification of the at-large representatives to 6 members to maintain the current membership of 10. And it adds that one member of those 6 representatives must have experience representing the interests of employees of the university.
Great. Folks, we've had this bill before us. Ms. Van Winkle has just described the amendments. Are there any questions or concerns about this bill? Will your questions require that Mr. Dempsey come up and...
No, okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious if you or Teresa or anyone has heard from the governor's office on this bill.
No, I have not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
I would just like to state that I consider it, for the record, deeply unfortunate that this bill may be necessary.
All right, let's try to echo that misfortune. Any other questions on this bill?
Mr. Chair, maybe not have done as much homework as I needed to on this bill. I'm trying to interpret this amendment. Does that require the governor to appoint somebody from one of two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, no, it does not. The focus of that appointment would be somebody that represents experience representing the interests of employees. It's not necessarily from AFSCME or ONA. It's from the employees at large.
So
it's how it's, the bill has now been rewritten with the amendment.
So we're adding under Section 2. I was under the impression that this was going to be under Section 1, and we were...
Representative, I'm going to share this. Mr. Dempsey, you want to come up and walk us through this, please?
Yeah.
I think maybe then some of our questions or concerns may be
answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jack Dempsey with the Oregon Nurses Association. If you want to repeat your question, Representative Cameron, I apologize.
I'd like you to walk us through the amendment
absolutely.
And how it works and where it's at and what we're changing. And what's going to be required of the governor, and who he's going to be required to appoint to this position. And then, Representative Cameron, if he still has a question, then he'll ask.
Gotcha. The main points of the -2 amendments, Mr. Chair, in Section 1, we keep the board currently at 10 members instead of going up to 11. In Section 1, Sub 2, we change the language there to show that the governor would appoint somebody that's with experience representing the interests of employees at the university and not representing the two collective bargaining units. The language is that the two largest collective bargaining units there would submit 3 names to the governor, and the governor would choose from those 3 names. In Section 1, Sub 4, where it says that it can be an employee of the university, we've struck that out, so it cannot be an employee of the university and therefore cannot be a member of either collective bargaining unit up there. And that's basically the gist of the entire bill.
It's possible, Jack, that it could be an attorney who's represented collective bargaining units as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be a former member of a union, does it?
No.
According to this
all.
Language?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, with this language, it can be anybody that represents the interests of employees as long as they're not an employee of the university.
I will, Mr. Chair. Is anybody from OHSU here? I haven't heard from them.
They are. Mr. Boehringer would be, I'm sure, happy
are
to
they
come
supportive
up
of this amendment?
Sure. Well, we're going to let him answer that question.
Oh, good. Great.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian Berry with OHSU. Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the Dash 2 amendments do take care of some of the concerns we have about the legal issues of having an employee on the board. And while we would support the Dash 2 amendments, we, however, still don't agree with the underlying theme of the bill that would label a slot on the board for somebody that represents the interests of employees.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? And I just want to get on the record. This is not a union versus OHSU bill. And this could have all been avoided had the request for someone who does have some experience in or representing labor had been appointed to the board in the first place. This all could have been avoided. I just want to share that right now, because this citizen of Oregon is eternally grateful for the OHSU, and every single day in my home I see and reap the benefits of that great institution, which I have completely and totally support in their mission, in the all the people they employ, the largest employer of the city of Portland, and the great services they provide, sometimes at no cost to the consumer or patient at all. So I really want to stress that this is not any way, shape, or form against that great institution. Any further questions of these good people? Representative Thatcher.
I'm sorry, I'm slow. Yes or no, you're supporting this bill, Bob Ryan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, we do not support this bill.
A fair question. I would entertain a motion. But before we do that, I will entertain a motion, then I'll speak.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2570.
Representative Holvey moves the Dash 2 amendments be adopted in House Bill 2570. Is there any questions, concerns, further discussion, or opposition to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'll support the Dash 2s in the amendment, but I will be a no on the bill coming out of the committee.
And we did just get the fiscal. Ms. Van Winkle is out making us copies right now. If I believe it says minimal fiscal impact on it, but you will have that in front of you. Okay, so is there any opposition to the amendment being put into the bill? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Holvey, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2570 to the floor with the as amended, with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Holvey moves House Bill 2570 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, questions, concerns, or opposition to the motion?
Okay. Just, Mr. Chair, I'll be a no, and the reason why is the governor has the ability right now today, when those positions are vacated, to appoint anybody he wants to, and I think he should have that continued freedom to do that, to work with OHSU, and if labor is part of that picture, then so be it. They should be there. We don't need to have a bill that forces that to happen.
Duly noted, Representative. Any further? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking to the record, I also just want to make it clear that this bill, even as amended, in no way alters the underlying fiduciary duties of, whether designated or no, each board member owes fiduciary duties, not to any interest group, but to the OHSU as an institution, and that this bill does not affect that. I also, at the risk of belaboring the point, want to express my deep disappointment that this bill may be necessary.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion before I have the clerk call the roll? And just saying, Representative Holvey moved the amendment.
Okay.
There was no opposition. There was no opposition to the motion of the amendment. And then Representative Holvey moved the bill. So I don't know if
that's fine.
Probably taken off. Okay. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Edwards. Aye.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Representative Holvey.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
No.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
No.
Chair Shoffler.
I'm sorry, did you call Representative Kinnerman?
No, I didn't.
He's excused. And I'm an aye. Okay, well, so moved. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this, or the chair will carry it? And let me have this one, I guess.
I'll all right. Carry it.
Don't we carry it? I appreciate your willingness to help.
Where would you carry it?
I'll carry it.
Let Chair Representative Matthews, so be it. Thank you very much.
All righty then. We are going to...
And are we moving this to judiciary?
No, we are hearing, having a full hearing on this, Mr. Chair. Yes, we are hearing it.
Because it wasn't, no, there.
No, we decided to keep it in the committee.
So. And then are we prepared to do that?
If the
we are. Paperwork-wise, yes, we're ready to move.
Very good. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2488.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2488 requires a public contracting agency to include in the public contract solicitation and in the contract's terms a provision that encourages bidders, proposers, and contractors to hire Oregon residents released from a Department of Corrections institution. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much. I'd like to call Representative Cameron.
Chair, thank you, committee members, fellow committee members, thank you. This bill before you today is a bill that's one of seven bills that the local Marion County Reentry Task Force has put together. As a member of the Governor's Reentry Council, I've been listening and hearing about some of the issues that we have for the people that are coming out of our corrections department and reentering into the real world. Obviously, the issues become they're very multiplying when people need housing, when people need jobs, training to be successful. And those of you that know me know that I'm pretty strong on crime and believe that we should be strong on crime, but also we need to have redemption, mercy, and grace for those people who have paid their dues. And this would be a bill that would help possibly get some of those people opportunities to have jobs when they come out and are back into the real world. So I know there's several people that testify on this, but this is one. And yesterday we passed two other bills out of the House Judiciary Committee with Representative Shields and myself as co-sponsors on those. So appreciate your listening to the testimony this morning and your support.
Thank you, Representatives. Anyone have any questions of Representative Cameron? Representative Matthews and then Representative Holvey.
Yeah, thanks, Representative Cameron, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, and we talked briefly, but can you kind of help me with the argument that some people are having, saying we're going to actually reward somebody that's served time in the Correctional Institute when people are out of work and they deserve the jobs first? I mean, I trust me, I'm tough on crime too, but I understand where this is going, and I appreciate the intent. But that's an argument that's been brought to me, is are we giving preferential treatment now to a corrections offender over someone that may be laid off and hasn't served time?
Yeah, Mr. Vice Chair, or Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, thank you for the question. I think we're going to hear some testimony as to the details of the bill. But the bill basically doesn't give individual preference to an individual. It's basically a contractor who may have these people working in their organization that has gone out of the way to maybe help those people. And this person may have been out of the corrections for quite a while. And again, if you... you know, and I use this as an example of my children when they've made a mistake and I've sent them to their room or whatever discipline that I've given them, and they've paid that price, and they've paid their dues back to the society by that discipline. At what point in time do I stop holding that over their heads and saying, you can be a productive member of this society? And this is not about denying somebody else a job. It is about recognizing that there are people that want to do the right thing that have made a mistake in the past. And this should help us maybe recognize that fact.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. In the description of the bill, it speaks of financial incentives. And can you describe what those financial incentives and other advantages that will be available to these bidders would be?
I don't know the details of what those are today. I know that there is a tax credit bill, one of the bills of the ones I described. There is a tax credit bill out there right now that, if passed, would allow an employer a tax credit up to $600 a year if they have hired a convicted felon and have worked through some training processes with them. There's also federal programs that are currently in law. I can't tell you, as an employer, it's so hard to get through some of those and what those are. You need to hire a consultant to figure out what's available and what's not available. So those are the types of things the bill is referring to.
And one more question.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. In addition, I'm kind of curious about there seems to be no reference to whether or not this particular individual coming out of corrections is qualified or has the skills necessary for certain contracts. So I'm wondering how you reconcile that when we have a lot of other folks who may be more qualified for hire.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, again, the details of the bill would need to be worked out, but the fact is the bill doesn't focus on an individual here. It focuses on a contractor. And the contractor, obviously, as a business person, is going to make decisions that are going to be productive for the business as a whole. And I don't believe they want to make decisions that would be, if the person wasn't qualified to be productive in their organization, I don't think they would make that decision. So we're talking about people who come out of a situation that have received skills, and there's some skills training that goes on while they're incarcerated at some point in time. Maybe somebody who's gone through a trade program and been developed, and I would assume those are the types of people that would be hired by contractors.
Any further questions of Representative Cameron? Thank you, Representative.
You're welcome.
Okay. We have three people, Janet Carlson, Jeff Wood, and Kimberly Elaine. Will you come on up? You can go in any order you'd like. Just state your name for the record, please.
Representative Barton, members of the committee, I am Commissioner Janet Carlson from Marion County. Very pleased to have the opportunity to be before you today. I want to give you a little bit of background about the genesis of these and the other six bills that Representative Cameron mentioned. 3 years ago, Senator Jackie Winters and Senator Peter Courtney got a bill passed through the session that started a methamphetamine task force, and it's been renamed since the Guido Calderazzo Methamphetamine Task Force in honor of a great citizen in our community. We started looking at sort of the drivers of around methamphetamine and kind of the results of, you know, we looked at the enforcement side, sort of the supply side. We also started looking at the demand side and what occurs when people are involved with meth. They commit a crime, they go into prison, they pay their debt to society, they come out. Now we're looking at trying to reunite folks with their families. We're trying to make sure that they are able to be successful and have a successful reentry. As part of that discussion, we actually did a survey at the Marion County Jail, and the handout that you're receiving really is just not really testimony, but a bit of a background paper that I is part of a larger report that actually is being presented to the legislature as part of this task force. What we found out was in interviewing 442 inmates, and we did the survey twice, and the numbers really weren't all that different. 73% of the inmates were parents, and out of that 442, 774 children were affected by incarceration. 81% of the mothers and 66% of the fathers hadn't graduated from high school. 74% reported having used methamphetamine sometime in their life, and 89% of the mothers reported meth use. 67% had a job prior to incarceration, but only 35% reported having employer-paid benefits. 77% of working parents earned less than $1,500 a month prior to incarceration, and 22% of fathers and 36% of mothers reported having no place to live after release. So what we looked at was really that there were five key factors influencing success after incarceration, and those were education, employment, substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, and housing. Marion County has the fifth largest population in Oregon, but we have the second largest population of offenders coming back to our community. We have 4 out of the 14 institutions here in Marion County. We also have the two larger juvenile facilities, McLaren and Hillcrest, and we have the state hospital. So what happens is we have a lot of folks that congregate in Marion County because they come to live close to their loved ones that are involved in one of our institutions. I started a group that reports to the Meth Task Force called the Barrier Busters also about 3 years ago, and we took this jail survey and started looking at what could we do as a community to start trying to turn lives around and make it so that people who were coming back into our community could be successful and not just have that cycle as well as their children having that cycle of criminality. We started a Children of Incarcerated Parents Initiative. We do parenting programs at our work center for folks that are involved. We had opened a Center for Family Success about a year ago where we do parenting and wraparound services with a particular emphasis on employment. We just opened a transitional housing unit, a 12-bed facility this week in the rain, and Representative Cameron was able to participate in that, as well as Senator Winter, Senator Courtney, and Max Williams, Director of Department of Corrections. And we have an employment initiative that we're just barely starting right now. For the employment initiative, we created a work group last summer. We had representatives from Chemeketa Community College, the Department of Human Services, St. Vincent de Paul, Kimberly is here, Community Corrections, also Corrections Industry, some folks that work at the state level with Department of Corrections, some folks from local businesses. We look nationally at what are some good ideas out there. What can we do to encourage employers to hire this population? And so we have a package of bills that we're actually using, we're calling them incentives or sweeteners or whatever, to help employers kind of get beyond the idea that maybe, you know, it's not a good idea to hire people that have a criminal record. Because what happens is if employers create policies that say, well, if you have a felony record, we're just automatically going to screen you out, how are folks going to get jobs? And if they don't have a job, how are they going to have a place to live? How are they going to provide for their families? And so then they end up going back into a criminal lifestyle. What's different about what's going on right now from what has gone on in the past is that we're learning through evidence-based practices how to determine whether people are, one, ready to work, and two, whether they're motivated. We started talking, actually, Ray Burstead, who is here and is the director of our Strategic Economic Development Corporation, has been a great person and really involved with us. And he and I went out and started talking to the consortium of manufacturing, food processors, wood, metals, and so on, and got some interesting feedback. And one of the pieces of feedback that I got in talking to the food processors, well, you know, we did this in the 80s and a truckload of offenders came in and they all worked on the assembly line and all of the other employees got nervous and it just wasn't a good thing and we don't want to do this again. And so what we're determining now through evidence-based practices, that's not really what we want to do. We want to find folks who are qualified, who are ready, who are motivated, and we want to have just a few people in a lot of businesses as opposed to having a whole truckload of people in one business. And so we have to spread folks around through the community. We don't have a lot of large corporations in Marion County. We have mostly small businesses. And so the idea of finding incentives for folks who are employers to be willing to hire folks who have a criminal record, either through a tax credit, through this kind of incentive, through the public contracting process, through some other of the bills that we have, is something that we think is a good idea. Now, we do recognize that there may be some technical issues with the bills. We are very open to amendments. Representative Cameron mentioned that he's heard from the League of Cities that they kind of want to know how would you document whether a employer actually has hired someone who is an ex-offender. I think Jeff Wood can speak to that a little bit. We just, again, conceptually spoke about whether it would be possible if the community corrections placed someone under supervision with an employer, whether they could then provide that employer with a document that would say, you know, you've now hired someone that is under our supervision. If a city had a solicitation, or the county or the state, much like the preference points that you use for emerging women, minority, small business, some of these other kinds of programs that are available, if they they would ask for that documentation, then it would be provided, and they could provide some sort of a preference or some sort of additional points in the contracting process. We provided this as a concept to Legislative Council. It was an idea that came out of the state of Illinois. I mentioned that we were looking nationally at good ideas. I don't know that there would necessarily be financial incentives. Representative Holvey, you asked that question. It could be simply a matter of some additional points if that employer hired someone who had that background. And I think Kimberly also will speak to whether people are ready and qualified, because we want to make sure that we, as you are all talking about, that we have the best employees. We just want to level the playing field and not exclude people with criminal records, which seems to be what's going on quite a bit today. So with that, I will close my testimony, and I don't know if you want to ask questions now or wait until my colleagues
just wait, everybody talk.
All right, thank you.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I am the acting lieutenant of the Parole and Probation Division of the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm here on behalf of the Sheriff's Office and in support of my fellow attendees, Marion County Commissioner Janet Carlson and St. Vincent de Paul Society Executive Director Kimberly Elaine. I'd also like to express my support of House Bill 2488. As a responsible body for reintegrating people releasing into the community from prisons and local jails, we, the Marion County Sheriff's Office, realize transition and reentry is a complicated process and no small task. Every year in Marion County, this translates into approximately 1,000 releases per year into our community, meaning more men and women will reenter society labeled an offender. When a released inmate reoffends, the results are immeasurable to the victims of recidivism. The results of recidivism are also substantial to the taxpayers and additional systems costs of law enforcement, the judicial system, and, of course, corrections. In an effort to reduce recidivism, the Marion County Sheriff's Office, in conjunction with St. Vincent de Paul Society, developed what we now call the Marion County Reentry Initiative. MCRI is designed to facilitate the transition process and provide social support, housing, employment, soft skills building, and job referrals to those offenders ready and motivated to make a positive change in their lives. One key component of those transitioning out of a correctional facility is to obtain viable employment. House Bill 2488 helps agencies like ours achieve this goal. Realizing there are many people who do not believe formerly incarcerated people deserve any kind of employment consideration, especially in these current economic conditions, I'd like to offer a slightly different perspective. Currently in Marion County, 4,300 souls that we are tasked to supervise, 60% are currently unemployed. All things being equal, lack of gainful employment can increase risk to the community and future costs in terms of higher recidivism rates and incarceration. Although I am here testifying before the House Business and Labor Committee, I consider employability of this population a public safety issue facing many community corrections offices throughout the state. Research shows those who obtain viable employment are at lower risk to recidivate versus those who are unemployed. Although this bill is no panacea for recidivism, it is a step in the right direction and a necessary tool in our toolbox in our ongoing effort to successfully reintegrate men and women into our communities throughout the state. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you, and I will be available for any questions.
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, I'm Kimberly Lane. I'm the Executive Director for St. Vincent de Paul Society of the Mid-Willamette Valley. Approximately 93% of those of 13,500 people who are currently incarcerated in the state of Oregon will be released back home. That's a significant number of folks that live in our community. Very significant number. As Lieutenant Wood referred, is a part of the Marion County Reentry Initiative, and it is a viable system alignment of how we work together as a community, not simply as corrections, not simply as law enforcement, not simply as nonprofits, not simply business. In order for every community member in our communities statewide to be healthy and whole, we need to look at ways that we talk, interact, and relate with each other. And the Marion County Reentry Initiative is strategically looking at that system alignment and creating that dialogue. Hence, the reason why we are here talking with you, particularly around employment for people with criminal histories. When folks come out of incarceration, prior to them coming out, we go in together, community corrections and our staff go in together and meet with folks being released to our county. And there's several reasons for that. One is to de-escalate the anxiety of returning home. That's a very delicate time for folks. And de-escalating that anxiety is simply preparing folks on what's going to happen, what's it going to be like, how will I be received, what services are available, how to transition, begin that planning process. The other thing that we do is we assess folks. What's their motivation to change? What things do they need? What's their need assessment? What's their risk to recidivate? We know those things prior to release, and we prepare plans so that they can be more successful. Just like any other citizen in our community, employment is critical. It is absolutely critical to be able to provide for oneself and one's family. The current practices of employers to date means that when we do a background check, almost all employers now do background checks. And people that have criminal histories generally are automatically screened out without consideration of skill set, motivation, or match. They're automatically removed from the playing field, from the competitiveness to the job. Having a criminal history in practice, the way that we are implementing employment practices currently, it now is a life sentence. That is not law. That is practice. And what we are supporting is a level playing field for all citizens to be able to compete for open positions, and that the employers can choose based off a skills match, that it's not an automatic life sentence because you have a criminal history. I get questioned all the time about preferential treatment of folks. We operate one of the largest emergency services food banks in Marion County. The month of January, we normally service about 600 people needing emergency food in our community. In January, it went up to 711 families, households. I have to tell you, I know on the ground the realities of the needs of our community. It's face-to-face. I have to say yes or no every day to folks. And I see the faces of who we're talking about, those who have criminal histories and those who don't. And I'm telling you, they're everyday people just like you and I, and they're struggling to make a difference for themselves and their families. The employment initiative is simply trying to level the playing field for everyone to be able to be successful based off of their ability, their motivation, and their skill sets. It is not preferential treatment. It is helping to remove the barriers that are keeping folks from the ability to compete and helping to incentivize employers to rethink their practices and policies. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'll be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Out here there's I support this bill. We're not going to work it today, but I encourage you all to go to every, I know your time is valuable. I want you to go to every single member of this committee and discuss this with them and see what they need to get to a yes. Okay, that's what first thing I want to say before I forget. But right out here on the Walk of Flags, I was one of the co-sponsors of Iowa Flag. And on the plaque it says, in honor of Ralph and Patricia Schaffler, my mom and dad. And then it says, Iowa, the beautiful land of my colorful youth, Representative Mike Schaffler. And if you were to put together a palette of the colors representing my youth, there would be some very bright colors. And there would be some grayer ones. And then there would be some dark ones. I grew up with a bunch of guys, my pals and I. We very much, it's a blessing that we all grew up in the middle of Iowa, in a little town. Because God knows where a lot of us would be. And I know where some of us ended up. These are guys I grew up with that were my best, closest friends. Some of them went to prison, some of them are dead. But most of us went to the other side of that razor's edge and are successful and happy and productive human beings. The guys that did go to prison, if you had met us when we were young, yeah, we were troublemakers, but
no different than anybody up here, to be quite frank with you. But for one reason or another, in their childhoods, that just things sent them in a direction, and some of them got their act together, and are not productive members of the community, and that's who I think we're talking about here. And you're right, it isn't a level playing field. To be quite frank with you, we're never going to have a level playing field. And I would not support a mandate to hire people with a criminal record. I wouldn't do that. But encouraging people and pointing out the positives of what they first, where they came from, what they went through, and what they've done to get their act together, mm-hmm. I think is definitely something we need to look at. But anyway, any questions? Okay, I'm just going to go Representative Holvey, Esquivel, Barton, Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if any of you can answer the question of whether or not our public entities themselves have, I guess, an encouragement for our state agencies, county agencies, to hire people that have come out of the correctional institutions.
Representative Holvey. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. I'm not aware of any local governance ordinance that requires or encourages any public entity to make those hires for people who are formally incarcerated, but I will say that in an effort to practice what they preach, there are government entities who have hired formally incarcerated people in positions that, ironically, they assisted with while they were incarcerated in various agencies, both state and local. And so while I wouldn't say that there's any public mandate or public encouragement to hire those individuals, I do know what goes on. Yes?
Yeah, follow up, Mr.
Please.
Chair. Well, I bring that up because I know that there are contractors out there that do hire right now people that come from correctional institutions after serving their time and paying their debt back to society without this bill. And evidently there are some agencies that do the same thing. I think if government wants this policy, they should put the policy on themselves first. And I say this, I have great empathy for the level playing field, but I do have some concern, I suppose, about that level playing field. If you're going to, I have some concern about how this is implemented and the vagueness of the bill, because if you're going to provide incentives based on per person hiring, I think that's going to create a disparity amongst contractors. Some contractors are going to have, training requirements, and they're going to have specific requirements to put some people on their jobs, and others will not. Mm-hmm. And so you could have a contractor who all of a sudden has a great financial advantage because they have hired 10 people from former correctional institutions, and some contractors who would be very difficult for them to get one person in because they must go through an apprenticeship program or they must have certain qualifications to get hired. And so now you're going to have a contractor who perhaps has a skilled workforce that has some requirements, and bidding against a contractor who doesn't have those kind of requirements, and so the less qualified workforce ends up getting awarded the job. Mm-hmm. So this level playing field that you speak of, I don't believe this bill gets us there. And so I have some great concerns how a bill like this would get implemented, and it's not clear exactly how those incentives would play out in the marketplace in the world of bidding, and it's unclear to me, how much this is actually going to cost. I recognize that the fiscal says minimal, but I'm not sure I'm totally assured that that is actually going to be the case. So I really have some concerns about how this bill is implemented. I'm not sure that it's really, this is the right way to get it, getting former folks that have a record into the workplace. I think there might be a different way to do this, essentially, rather than putting in incentives into a bidding world that I think will create an unlevel playing field and and possibly a skill down of contractors who will actually be awarded the jobs. So I just wanted to express those concerns that I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of you want to respond to that? And while you do, is there a definition somewhere of applicable financial incentives or other advantages available to a bidder? And if you don't know right now, it's okay. If it does exist in statute or rule somewhere, I'd be interested in myself and the rest of the committee's hearing and seeing and learning that. And I would like you to respond to Representative Holley's concerns. I share his concerns, by the way. I'm not going to beat around the bush at that. So,
Mr. Chair, when you were out of the room in my testimony...
Forgive me.
I
apologize
all the time.
For that.
I mentioned that this was an idea, a concept that came out of the state of Illinois, and part mm-hmm. of the language is directly out of their statute. I'm not quite sure what the definition is of the applicable and financial incentives. What we had anticipated in looking at their language is that there'd be something like preference points that would be awarded in a public contracting process, you know, 5 extra points or whatever, if you could show documentation that your company hired one or more people that had been formerly incarcerated. And we talked about the idea that perhaps the community corrections directors could provide documentation to the employer upon placing a person in employment with them that they could provide then to the city or county or state entity that did the contracting. But we are very open to amendments to the bill. We're not experts in the public contracting process, and this was meant to initiate a conversation about how we might provide some incentives for employers. We know there are many employers that hire people who have been offenders, but there are also many who do not. And so this is something to kind of get those folks to the next level.
And I'm all for the conversation and continue to have it. And I certainly want to avoid the pitfalls that my friend down here just pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And let me be very clear. I don't want to set up a system where a contractor makes more money because they hire a bunch of people that have been in prison,
mm-hmm.
To the detriment of other contractors who, just for one reason or other, aren't in that situation. I definitely don't want to do that. But
great.
I do support what you're trying to do here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can get to yes if we can find the language. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some concerns as well as what my fellow representatives have, but a couple of clarifications. One is that it was brought up a question of how would you verify this? I believe, Lieutenant, you can check into your leads, LEDS, and you can find out in a heartbeat what was on the payroll. Is that correct?
Representative Esquivel, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, if you're asking if we could confirm somebody's criminal history, provide verification of that, and provide that to any prospective employer, yes, we can do that.
And it's not very extensive, is it? It doesn't take much effort to do that.
No. The manpower, the effort, the labor is minimal.
Yeah. The other...
Please, go ahead.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The other thing that comes into play here is I would assume that, and of course this is an assumption because it is not spelled out, that you would have some sort of a certification on the criteria locally whether these individuals did qualify in this bidding process with the hiring of people that have been in correctional institutes and also at the end of the process that they did actually work. Is that correct? I mean, I could say that I have 10 people out here, give you names of people, but it doesn't necessarily mean they'll work on that job. That's something that I think we need to have a trigger or some sort of a threshold that we look into.
Some verifiable enforcement of this. So that I love this conversation.
Representative Esquivel. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, just as information, on a routine basis, whenever somebody who is on supervision reports into their supervising parole and probation officer, deputy, whatnot, verification of employment is sort of a standardized process that we go through. At times, we talk directly to the employers. We get confirmation on payroll, receipts from employers, making sure that the job is legal and that they are receiving monies, they are paying taxes. taxes, so to speak. So some of that verification that I think you're getting at is something that we could be able to do, or you're shaking your head, so that's not answering your question at all. My apologies.
I must apologize to you, sir, because obviously I didn't make it clear enough. When they're working on the project that they've applied for, granted, how do you verify that they worked on the project? And it wouldn't have necessarily be a parolee. It could be someone that had been incarcerated, like you used an example, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, that had no parole experience at that point.
Representative Esquivel, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. Yes, in terms of the example you're giving of the verification of actual employment on the site, would be something that in terms of somebody who is on supervision currently, is something that we would be open to exploring, open to any advice. In terms of people who are not on supervision, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms there would be some difficulty for any community corrections office in the state to do that. But again, we'd be open to any suggestions or comments.
And before I go to Representative Barton, if somebody's going to get a financial incentive, mean money, I think we need to make sure and verify that they are doing what we're asking them to do, and not sort of some standards or sort of do it. I'm using your words, sir. I mean doing it and verifying it every single time. And that's a big, high bar to breach. So I think maybe the conversation may be taking that out of the bill and encouraging people to do this. That's just a suggestion. Representative Barton. Oh, forgive me, Representative.
One last thing.
And then we're moving on.
And I agree with Chair Schaffer on this issue. This is just encourages people. That's all it does. And I think that's fine. I don't have a problem with this. But the devil is in the details, folks.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me preface my question by saying how much I enjoyed, Mr. Chair, your opening comments regarding Iowa and your background and the plaque out there. And
quite well.
However, Mr. Chair, as your vice chair and as a freshman member of this assembly, it is my duty to inform you, and I'm not kidding, actually, that your plaque has been stolen. I'm not kidding.
Not the Iowa one, has it?
I believe it has, Mr. Chair. And metal theft is a problem, which is why I know I can count on your support for the metal theft bill I am working on, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Apologies, Mr. Chair. Regarding another question, I think there's quite a bit of consensus back here. I think most of us, if not all of us, actually support the intent of this bill, and we all have some concerns, and I think those concerns have already been expressed, and so I should not repeat them. I can think that they actually could be kind of summarized in all the variations, I think, in three categories. Number one is we don't want to create an unlevel playing field. It's just a question of equity and fairness. I think that's going to be the first source of our concerns. Number two is, I think, just vagueness of statute. If you look at the statute right now, kind of the Section 2, Subsection 2, right now, it's just a little vague, and we aren't exactly sure right now, the statute as written, what it means, and I think it's going to require some more clarity before this panel is satisfied. And number three would be administrability, and how, I think as Representative Esquivel pointed out, how actually this will be administered in practice. And I think if we clarify it, that will, the second problem, it will also address in large part both the first and third problem. And there are a lot of ways we can go about that. I think the statute should actually define more and be more specific. I also think that perhaps it is possible, another way of tackling some of these issues is a very narrow delegation of authority to the relevant agency, perhaps DAS. Frankly, I'm not sufficiently familiar with the public contracting code to know the best way going about that. But I think that some rules might be necessary to actually administer this. But I think before this committee would feel comfortable delegating the authority to make those rules, the underlying statute will have to be more clear. Look forward to working with you on that.
If you're going to respond, Representative, I just want to clarify something. Are you referring to clarity in existing statute or referring to more clarity in this proposed bill?
I was referring to this proposed bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Would you like to respond to that? Okay. All right. Feel free if you want to.
Yeah.
All right, great. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions, if you don't mind, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please, go ahead.
My first question is it your intent to make this for first offenders or offenders? I'm just kind of curious. You know, I mean, I just want to tell you from the get-go, too, I have some problems with this bill. I had them long before I was ever contacted, before we ever had a conversation, before your testimony. I think they have to do with leveling the playing field, but also I spent a great deal of my life in law enforcement and now in fire, and I also have spent a great deal of time talking to kids about consequences and the results of something you do or choose not to do. Mm-hmm. Very much a firm believer that there are consequences in life, and people know that at the onset. When we're getting ready to deploy about 3,000 of our veterans to come back home in about 18 to 20 months, I'd like to see us hire veterans first and not put them on the same field as offenders. That's my take on it. So I just have a couple questions, and maybe you can answer. The first is about, is this a first-time offender that good people make bad choices? We know that can happen. Is that what we're looking, or are we looking at offender period, second, third, fourth time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews. The perspective I would take is that it's based off of motivation, assessment, and merit. That there are first-time offenders that would be, as an employer, would not be appropriate match for a job. Their motivation's not right. They've not learned their lesson. So to cut it at that level would not get, I believe, at what your intent is as far as making sure that the consequences are realized. Someone who's motivated to change and to do the right things have spent some cognitive energy restructuring their thinking, reflecting on behavior, and taking the steps necessary to change that behavior. Those are the folks that we are targeting with this employment incentive. So if we limit it to a category first offense, second offense, or something like that, I don't think we would get at the intent of what we're trying to accomplish.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So who determines the suitability then at this point in the Corrections Institute? How's that going to happen?
Representative Matthews, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee.
Okay.
Just to reiterate what Kimberly Lane was saying, I don't think we're looking so much at in terms of first-time offender or multiple offender. I think what we're looking for is the right offender. Hopefully, to answer your question, who determines that? One of the nice things over the last 30 years of correctional research is there are actually assessment tools, motivation tools that we can use that have a high degree of validity within them to predict somebody who is motivated to change. We can apply these assessment tools. In the vernacular, we assess for a stage of change within each individual so that we can refer the right person, the motivated person, the person who wants to make significant changes in his or her life, to the program, so to speak. And so with the assessment, with review of the information, and compliance from the supervising officer, we feel that we have a fairly accurate degree of validity in terms of making sure that we can refer the right people for this program.
Okay, and so with this particular referral program, how many of these offenders have you rehired into Marion County throughout the county system? How many ex-felons or offenders has Marion County hired as a result of your program in the county itself?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, as I mentioned, the employment part of it has just barely begun. We have an employment integration specialist and another employment specialist that we're seeking to hire to work with local businesses. We are looking at policies. We are working together. So I don't have numbers to give you in terms of how many people Marion County itself has hired. I couldn't tell you how many women or how many anything else are in Marion County today. I can get you that information. However, I think that the issue that we're looking at here is that we have a different way because of evidence-based practices. Dr. Ed Latessa has trained a lot of folks in the state of Oregon. They're looking at how do we know whether a person is sincerely interested in changing. And the point being that if someone has made a mistake in their past and has done their debt to society, whether it's a first offender or whether they've done it multiple times, at some point in their life, as they come into the community, the question is, should they get a job or shouldn't they get a job? And we believe that someone having a job is the community's better off than someone not having a job.
Right.
I can tell you that in Marion County, we have a person in the health department who had an addiction issue, and it came to the board about whether or not we were willing to hire this person. And the point that was made to us as a board was that this person actually had empathy for the very folks that that person was going to deal with. And as a board, we approved that hire. But we have to do these things with skill, with sensitivity. It's not a level playing field. What it's been in the past is a playing field where it's the worst common denominator. We assume, because someone has a criminal record, that they're all bad people. What we're trying to say is that people are people, and there's a wide range. There are people that are very willing to change, and there, but we don't give them a chance. There are people that should not be employed that are coming out of prison and need a whole lot of work, and every gradation of gray in between. And so to be able to figure out how to place the right people in the right positions, this is what we're trying to do, and we need some tools in the toolbox to make it happen. This is just one of seven tools.
Before Mr. Representative Matthews follows up with one more question, and then I go to Representative Witt, we are going to have another hearing on this. I think you are going to have to put some different language in here, amended language, and I want you to once again get the ideas from these nice folks that we need to vote for it, because I have another bill that I really have to get to today. But we're going, and the good gentleman, Mr. Winkles from Levy Morgan Cities, generously offered to not testify today. Thank you for your generosity in that, for the sake of time. So I'm going to go to Representative Matthews for one more follow-up, then Representative Witt, then one person still has to testify, and then we're moving on.
It was just back to my question, I guess, and I understand, you know, the context of the statement, but my question was specifically before, not how many businesses have you asked in Marion County, not how many local folks you've asked to employ these people, how many people have you personally, as Marion County, employed that are corrections offenders that have gone, you know, they've come out of your correctional institute and now work for the county specifically, not, as a government agency, not businesses in the county. How many offenders do you have working in the
Marion
County?
That's just a number, and if you don't,
you don't have
the
to give me that
today,
I'd like
you to get it for us. We don't need a long, drawn-out answer to that question. Thank you very much for your patience. My pleasure. Excellent questions, Representative. Exactly what we need to be doing here. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to speak to the level playing field issue. And but before I do, I want to thank Representative Cameron for bringing this bill forward, because this is a population that needs our help. And I think his reminder that we need to consider redemption and mercy and grace is an important one. So I want to get to yes on this bill. But I want to also make sure that we are not creating a group that is undercutting area wages and standards. And simply because they are an offender group and can't expect to earn a wage rate commensurate with the rest of society, that we set up a substandard shop. And I am absolutely convinced that that is a concern of mine that can be easily dealt with here, and I will be able to get to yes on this.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you very much. I think you see what your charge is, and I'm confident you can do whatever it is you need to get this bill passed. But thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
just if I may, Scott didn't testify, but it'd be real important that maybe you can meet. He's in the back room. Meet with him and see what any other issues that he may have had that didn't get on the record.
And he is going to get, I'm telling you, on the record right now, he will get a chance to testify. And I'm sure it'll, in all likelihood, be different language. I just want to make sure that we get that on there. We want to make sure the League of Oregon Cities is recognized for all the valuable work they do in this great state. And we will have you up here, sir. Thank you very much.
Jim, may I just ask on the amendment
very,
process?
Very, very briefly.
Do you want to do it through the committee or through Representative Cameron? Who would you like us to work with on the amendments?
Oh, Representative Cameron will give you a note. Or you pick whoever you feel more comfortable with.
We'll work with Representative
Thank you very much.
You want to work with the committee?
We'll
work
Let's with we're going to figure okay. that out later. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. Keep doing your good work. I have Mr. Ray Burstead. Please, sir. Come on up.
It's on this bill. Thank you, Chairman Schaffler. Members of the committee, my name is Ray Burstead. I'm the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation. I have been working with Commissioner Carlson and the other members of the committee in all of these issues for the last 3 years. I have nothing to add. My colleagues covered the situation very well, and we have listened to what you have had to say. I would add one thing, and that would be that someday we're going to have economic recovery. I don't know how far down the road that is, but my job as president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation is jobs, and it's jobs for Oregonians and all Oregonians. Thank you.
And any questions to Mr. Burstead? And would you do me a favor, if you have time, come around to the committee and talk about the advantage of this, because it is important. And I believe, I'm confident we can get to yes on this. I certainly want to encourage people to hire folks that deserve a chance.
Thank you, Chairman.
No, thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming here today, too. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2488, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2430.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2430 defines building construction and modifies the definition of residential construction for purposes of applying prevailing wage rates to projects that predominantly provide affordable housing. There is an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage.
Very good. I'm going to call up... So, Mr. Anderson, Ann Williams, and John Rakowitz, please. Go ahead, Michael. You're the first one to sit down. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. Thank you very much for this hearing this morning. This is a bill that is fixes in some ways a small problem, but a problem with a very significant impact.
Oh, Michael, for the record.
My name is Michael Anderson. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Opportunity Network. The Oregon Opportunity Network is a trade association of nonprofit housing developers that provide affordable rental and home ownership opportunities, as well as home ownership counseling across the state of Oregon. So this is a bill that is fixing a problem that we meant to address in 2007 in the very big overhaul of the prevailing wage and the application of the policy. The intention that we have is to address this problem, to give clear guidance to the Labor Commissioner so that there's consistency and clarity in terms of the application of the affordable housing exemption to projects that are mixed use. What I mean by a mixed use project is a project that has both a residential element and a commercial element. This is a very common practice that affordable housing, nonprofit affordable housing providers are asked of cities around the state of Oregon. Oftentimes what this looks like exactly is that the ground floor of a unit would have, the ground floor of a building would have some type of commercial enterprise that can range from being the offices of the nonprofit that owns the building, that could be providing services for the people living in the building, such as drug and alcohol counseling, such as mental health services. It could range to a Starbucks or to a exercise fitness center, a regular private business that you might see anywhere. As I said, this is a problem that in some ways is small. The reality of the amount of projects that are affected by this proposed amendment are between 3 and 7 a year. Because of the very nature and limits to the affordable housing exemption, which is, to be clear, means a building cannot go above 4 stories and has a requirement to be serving people at a low income, which for the purposes of this committee, I'm going to put at around $30,000 or lower for the people living in these units. When I say 3 to 7 projects a year, that's on the upper end, about 300 units of affordable housing. So in some ways, we're talking about 300 units total, between the 3 and 7 projects, we're talking about a very small share of significant work. On the other hand, why it's important to the affordable housing community is, frankly, that's the pace that we're able to provide very important needed housing to communities throughout Oregon. The people living in this housing, you know, I put 30,000 as sort of a upper limit, but more typical, the people living in this housing are earning between $17,000 and $24,000. That's very significant, particularly when you're talking about having dependents such as children or when you're talking about seniors on fixed incomes, which are really at that lower level. So I'm going to briefly give you a little bit of history and then bring you forward to what we're trying to accomplish here. So starting in 2006, my organization, which for purposes of history was at that point two organizations, we've since merged, but at that point we were sitting down at the table with the Oregon Building Trades Council, the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, and we came together to figure out a solution that would work for the construction trades as well as would work for affordable housing, so that when we went into the 2007 legislature, we could participate and wholly support and back the values that we support, which is that workers who are working on projects with public money ought to have the protection of prevail wage. That's what we believe. In this process of going forward, though, we identified a narrow band of projects, these projects under 4 stories in height, that there's certain barriers that having those projects prevail prevents significant challenges to my membership. Very specifically, in rural communities, getting small contractors to bid on projects that prevailed became a barrier not because of the wages, but because of unwillingness to fill out the paperwork. Now, do I think that that's right or wrong? I don't think that that's right. I'll tell you that. Do I think that's real? Yes, that's real. That's a real barrier that my members were facing, literally not getting people to take bids. So when we sat down with the carpenters and the building trades, we said, this is this narrow band of housing. We don't see this as being a huge part of the work share, but it's a real barrier that we're facing. So we went forward with this spirit, and the intention in 2007 was included in the affordable housing exemption to have some pathway to deal with these mixed-use commercial residential projects. We did not achieve what we needed to in 2007. The lack of clarity in the law has created a confusion and project delays, which has left several of my members sort of stuck in a spin cycle. And what I mean by that is affordable housing deals, unfortunately, happen on a shoestring. And they also happen on an extended development period that is much more rigorous and challenging than your regular development in the private market. What I mean by that is that oftentimes for my members to get a deal done, they have to start lining up the actual numbers for their deals 2-3 years in advance before ground is ever broken. Why this becomes important is, therefore, you need to have very clear guidelines of how these laws will be applied such that people can make that determination ahead of time and know that, in fact, they are correctly assessing the wages that they should be providing for the workers on their job. What's happened in this interim period, call it foolhardy on our part, but we thought the deal in 2007 was something that was very clear and was going to happen. We were wrong about that. I had members with projects in 2005 and 2006 that were holding out for this fix because they thought, okay, this is going to be the clarity we need. Some of those projects at this point, they've either had to figure out how they were going to deal with this lack of clarity, or they have been we have one project that removed a whole floor from the deal that they were doing in order to fit into the window that was there. What this means in the real world is that these projects for seniors, for people with disabilities, for working families earning low wages are not being completed in the timely nature that they need to be. What it also means is for these small nonprofit community providers that are trying to provide this essential need in a very difficult environment, we're putting up extra barriers that are making it more complicated to get to the end goal that we all have, which is that there's housing options for the range of earnings across the state.
So, where we are going forward, one of the things that was very helpful sitting down with the building trades and the carpenters in 2006 is we realized that we had a great deal of shared value. One of the things that I think all of us believe is that working families deserve the opportunity to succeed in life. And that starts with having a place that you can afford, which is really hinges to having an income that can get you there. For some people, the income level of what they're getting from their job is not there yet. And talking about in this narrow band of smaller projects, we realized that we had a shared interest in saying prevailing wage for these projects will not be applied. But it wasn't as simple enough as saying, and that takes these non-profit affordable housing providers off the hook. They can do what they want. As a matter of fact, we also engaged in a sister document to our deal that we had for the 2007 legislature, a memorandum of understanding, where my members have agreed to work with members of the building trades and the carpenters to receive training and how we can better evaluate worksite conditions. We've also established a process when there are bad actors who are employing illegal but not necessarily uncovered as illegal yet practices on the job site, a way that my members can get information so we're not using our funds to build this affordable housing to support nefarious organizations who do not have the best intentions of workers in mind. So my point of giving you this history is to say there's been a lot of good faith and a lot of sitting around the table. So let's flash forward. Where are we now? Where we are now is that we have tried four different paths to figure out what is the fair, equitable way to deal with this mixed-use commercial residential mix. The original concept that we talked about in 2006 literally said if you have 60% of the building occupied at the residential level in the affordable housing exemption, that would carry you far enough for a mixed-use commercial. We didn't get the language correct for that, and I think actually as we looked at it closely, that was way too broad and we need to narrow it down. In 2007, the Association of General Contractors joined our effort in this building, working with the building trades, and came up with crack number two at addressing this, which was to split the projects out and to make a split determination where the commercial was evaluated singularly and then the residential portion was evaluated singularly. We thought that we had language that addressed that in the 2007 bill. Much to our chagrin, we did not. So we went back immediately to the drawing board and said, what else could we come up with? We came up with two other solutions that right now are the two solutions that I would say we continue to talk about and wrestle with to get to a shared consensus to bring to you. Those two solutions, one is looking at what does the federal government do under Davis-Bacon. And what we did is we went to the Department of Labor memos and we found how they defined a concept called incidental. If you will, very briefly to tell you what that is that in a construction project, if under 20% of that construction project is different than the primary purpose of it, as long as it's under 20%, it's incidental to the project. Okay? So what we're saying is, well, that's a pathway. If the commercial space is under 20% of the project, we could follow that pathway that the DOL has laid out. The other option that we're looking at is based on the occupants. You know, one of the intentions as we first sat around is to say, you know, we don't want to ding the nonprofit that has the mental health or drug and addiction services for having their office in the residential apartment if we know that helps those residents succeed, get back on their feet, become productive again. And the way that would work is if the occupant of the commercial space was to be a nonprofit, then that commercial space would be exempt. If that occupant was to be the Starbucks, the you know, workout facility, private gym, whatever, then that project would prevail. The one sticking point that we found on that from a technical issue is you don't always know who that resident's going to be. You have the best intentions. I have a member, this is sort of the flip scenario, who thought that she was going to have a dentist move into the ground floor of an apartment complex. The entire ground floor was plumbed to have a dentist's office in there. The dentist's office went under, unfortunately, in this difficult economy. Now her nonprofit is housed in a place that's suitable to have seven dental stations. But that's how it played out. So that's the situation.
Mr. Anderson, I know a real good dentist we can refer.
I need one.
Dr. Francis Sunseri, Southeast 91st and Jefferson.
Phone number? Beautiful house, District 51.
And you can get your tires at Alan Brown's Les Schwab.
So to wrap this up with respect to the time constraints that we're facing, and I think I've covered this briefly, but I want to emphasize again that affordable housing development, for better or for worse, has become extraordinarily complex, and that these deals happen oftentimes, particularly in this economy, with the lending restrictions and the inability of investors who formerly were key to affordable housing to be participating. To have delays like this creates a ripple effect around confidence. When the confidence isn't there with the investors and the lenders in this already jittery environment, we're talking about if we don't clean this up and fix it up, we're putting deals in jeopardy and not happening. That's why this is so important. Chair Soffler, I want to extend my appreciation for the meeting on Tuesday that you called together. We're very willing to continue to sit down and work out these final details and put this issue to bed like we thought we had in 2007. I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Ma'am, you go first, please.
Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee, I'm Ann Williams. I'm housing director for St. Vincent de Paul of Lane County. And I want to put a personal face on this and give you an example of a project that we are struggling to bring our partnership to closure so that we can begin construction, hopefully in July. The land building is a 35-unit mixed-use project with four floors of residential and one floor of commercial. The commercial is less than 20% of the total square footage of the building. The building will house individuals with incomes from $11,000 to $14,000 a year. That's a pretty skinny budget for anyone. We're struggling right now to hold those rent levels to be affordable for the population between that income bracket. One of the issues that we faced, we modeled the current building that I'm describing after another building that was completely exempted from prevailing wage that we completed 2 years ago in Springfield. The construction documents that building had did not trigger a commercial evaluation of that particular project. So we thought we were reasonably clear about what we needed to do, but in our first bully review, it came back that the entire project was prevailed. This would have basically killed the project. In this climate, finding additional funding and finding lenders who will stay with you while a period of uncertainty is traveled through would have been impossible. We resubmitted to BOLI, and the understanding was we will separate the project from a residential component and a commercial component. What this has necessitated is redrawing plans that had already been approved, separating the commercial aspect completely from the residential, and we will be tracking two sets of wage criteria. One is the Davis-Bacon residential, and the other will be the commercial. And this will probably add some, probably 20% in cost to the commercial development simply because of the additional bookkeeping that's going to be required to make sure that the guy who's working on the residential gets paid part day for the residential, and maybe as he comes downstairs and works on the commercial, his wage rate is going to have to be different, and we're going to have to track those things separately. If we had a clear test of how we treat mixed-use projects, we would not be going through project redesign right now. We would not be doing constant daily hand-holding with our limited tax credit partner and our permanent lender going, it's fine, we're going to get there, it's fine, we're going to get there. Many folks are looking at their financing and really holding their breath. We're very fortunate. We have an excellent track record. We've worked with many of our partners and our tax credit syndicators for years, so they have great confidence in our ability to move through this project. Not all nonprofit housing developers are so fortunate. This has been incredibly stressful for the housing development staff, and I think if we can finally have a bright white light that we can all sort of look to for guidance as we formulate projects, as we develop projects, and as we carry them through funding, we'll save a great deal of time, we'll save a great deal of energy, and we'll provide our lenders and syndicators with a great deal of assurance that our project, as we initially described it, is the project that we're asking them to risk funding on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Rakowitz. I'm the Public Affairs Director for the Associated General Contractors of Oregon, and we're pleased to be here today as both a supporter and a co-sponsor of this bill. We believe, as earlier testified, this is one of those perhaps little bills that can make a big difference in the real world, and it's an ongoing struggle to do affordable housing in the state of Oregon, and that's why we're involved. You've heard there's a couple of different paths. We're not particularly advocating an individual path. What we're advocating is to continue down the road with whatever set of amendments is agreed to by all the parties, and parties including the building trades in particular, and particular crafts that have specific needs here that need to be met in the amendments and how we approach this. Secondly, the affordable housing community developers really do need certainty, and they've made that clear. And then finally, Boley needs a bill that they can implement. And Chair Schaffler, I would add our appreciation as a supporter of this bill, bringing us all together earlier this week. I think we made some progress. And I would underscore in these particular times that certainty, in particular for affordable housing lending, the 2 to 3 years before, if you cannot get a pro forma that is clear about what your costs are going to be, you're going to undermine, you're going to delay, and you're going to end up scrapping projects. That's just what's going to happen in the world we operate in today. So that certainty is what we're after. I don't know that there are real amendments yet today, but we're all working at that, and we're just here to support that as long as it includes all parties being clear about exactly what it is, how to define a very narrow exception to the prevailing wage for a very particular small set of projects. And that's what we believe that the job of this bill will do.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and yeah, we... I don't think anybody up on this committee wants to slow or delay or prevent projects from going forward. I mean, we want people out there building America. I know I do. And we have gotten closer. The parties involved have gotten closer. And I'm confident we can bring this to a clarified bill, clarified language that the commissioner can implement and make sure everybody's getting paid what's due them out there and provide housing for good people who need it. And that's my goal, and I'm sure we're going to get there. I appreciate you spelling it all out in detail for us from just about every angle we can imagine. Representative Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comments, and am very supportive of affordable housing. Yet at the same time, I was very troubled by the bill that was passed last session as well. Strictly speaking, I guess it's troubling to me that the prevailing wage becomes the issue that makes or breaks a particular project. And I understand that sometimes the prevailing wage documentation and paperwork can be onerous, but really it's about the wages that are paid on these particular projects. And notwithstanding that, it sometimes is troubling to see people that work on these projects that are paid far below the average in the county on projects that generally in the past have been commercial. And I do have some concerns about this bill, and specifically, I do have some concerns about how we deal with the parking structures that are oftentimes underground below these projects that have typically been commercial construction and not residential construction. So I'm curious how they fit into this percentage. And so I would want to have some clarity on that. And I appreciate St. Vincent de Paul's work in my community on this, but at the same time, I have watched some of these multi-commercial and residential projects go up where people were working on some underground parking and major concrete construction that were not paid commercial rates and, in fact, were being paid as independent contractors on projects, which is very troubling to me to see go on, because oftentimes these people are taken advantage of and don't even make enough money to be able to qualify for the affordable housing rents that are on these specific projects. So I just wanted to express my concerns. I hope that I can get to a position to support this bill, but I do have some concerns. Thank you.
I hope you can get there too, Representative, and I share your concerns. And I'm a simple guy. Commercial's commercial, housing's housing. I don't know how you're going to draw that line in language, but that's what it is. You got a big, huge underground concrete parking lot and a commercial component, I think, and you're using government money, that should all be prevail. It's commercial work. You got a concrete elevator shaft, that is commercial work. And I share his concerns. Michael, I don't know how you get to this language, but I think we can get there. But I definitely share, and I shared Representative Holley's concerns 2 years ago as well. And then housing, then that's exempt, unless it's above a certain height, as I understand the statute. Would you like to respond to Representative Holley's comments or anything I've said?
Yes, Chair Schaffler and Representative Holvey and members of the committee. I appreciate your concerns as well, and let me just share a couple things that I hope will allay some of those concerns. First of all is we are more than amenable to figuring out what if we were to go in the direction where the commercial space were to prevail in some ways of having a very clear and firm backstop so that there is no multi-level parking garage. In reality, and this is my second point, unfortunately, for affordable housing, going back to the razor-thin lines of development, we can't afford parking. So as much as I would say that I can't speak to the projects that you were specifically referring to in the past, I can tell you quite clearly that I can't think of any current examples of my members with a project with a concrete parking structure under it, except for one rehab project that's happening up in Portland where there was parking below it already. So, which, again, there's significant work going on there. I'm not getting into that project. But I guess what I want to address, though, is that I'm very open to figuring out how we rein this in so we don't create some bugaboo where workers can get ripped off. That is not our intention. And I also would say in the real world, I think that we can find that there's not going to be too many examples where we could where such an escapade could happen. But we're willing to hem it in to make sure it doesn't happen.
Thank you. Representative Edwards, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like there's a bit of work to be done yet, and I just wanted to point out for other members of the committee that might not have been here in 2007 that the word bright line was used probably no less than 100 times during the testimony in 2007. I want to thank the three of you for not using that term bright line. And if anybody uses that term bright line between now and the passage or work session on this bill, they jeopardize the very future of the bill.
Thank you, Representative. I think you've drawn a bright line for all of us. And I appreciate that. Believe me, I do. Representative Thatcher, please.
Just a real quick question. What was the bill number from last session that we are fixing?
Do you remember?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, the ultimate bill, we actually had it in two versions in the House. I don't recall the bill number off the top of my head, but the bill that was enacted was House Bill 2140. 2140, thank you.
Any further questions of these nice people? And this is a work in motion, folks. This language isn't going to be the language. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
I would like, and we will have another public hearing on the language, obviously, because I have Michael or someone come up and walk through it with us. Norman Malbin, and it's spelled Cherry, but it's Cherry or Sherry Harris?
It's Cherry.
Oh, well, please come on up, Cherry. Whenever you're ready, whoever wants to go first.
Go first.
check you guy.
Definitely ladies first. Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Norman Malbin. I'm the general counsel of IBW Local 48. I'm a member of the TWR Advisory Committee and have been for 10 years. I was the chair of it for 4 years. I am here to speak on behalf of Local 48. I am not here to speak on behalf of the PWR Advisory Committee. I support affordable housing. I do not support 2430. I support projects for seniors and disabled and agree that working families deserve an opportunity to succeed. I do not agree that the prevailing wage law is a barrier. Just by way of background, from 1980 to 1985, as the Director of Research for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, one of my responsibilities was the administration of Oregon's Little Davis-Bacon Law. You heard that 2430 is designed to fix a problem from 2 years ago. I was not involved in the drafting of 2140, but I have discussed this with former Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner, who was very involved in the drafting of 2140. In an unrelated matter a few months ago, he wrote an affidavit that I provided to you. And among other things, he states that in developing 2140, it was our intent to exempt affordable housing standalone projects that were four stories or less and constructed of wood frame. 2140 was never intended to apply to projects that combine both residential and commercial elements. For example, if the first floor is commercial and the next three are residential, the affordable housing law we developed, House Bill 2140, was never intended to apply. I contacted Commissioner Gardner, former Commissioner Gardner, a couple of days ago. I told him about House Bill 2430. He was already very aware of it. I asked him about his affidavit. He said, absolutely, he stands by it, and it applies, and he would be happy to discuss that with anyone who wants to talk to him. Commercial work has never previously been exempt from Oregon's prevailing wage law. Under House Bill 2430, it would be. In addition, it seeks to exempt a whole new class of work. The definition of public works historically has been construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting. And in this bill, the definition adds a term. It is construction, reconstruction, major renovation, painting, and conversion. Conversion is where you take a big old, like, hotel, convert it to apartments or condos. With respect to the term incidental work, it is true. The Department of Labor does have language in the all-agency memo 130 and 131 regarding incidental work, and up to 20% of incidental work is, be careful how I describe it. It's not excluded. The term incidental work is used to describe items that are different but do not alter the overall character of the work. If you build a dam, if you build a wastewater treatment plant, that is what is called heavy. When you build a project like that, you often build a building. The wage schedule, there's a wage schedule for heavy, there's a wage schedule, a wage schedule for building. And the question is whether a separate wage schedule should be issued for the building portion. When you build an apartment house and there is paving for a parking lot, the question is whether there should be a separate schedule for the parking lot as opposed to the residential building. But I would suggest that if you're building an apartment house, you cannot honestly say that having the first floor consist of businesses, offices, Starbucks, is incidental to the overall character of the residential project. But there's a bigger issue. When DOL discusses incidental, the issue, as I said before, is whether there should be a separate wage schedule. The question is never whether commercial work should be excluded from the prevailing wage law. Under House Bill 2430, up to 20% of the project would be excluded. $8 million project, $2 million. That's a lot of work. Mixed use. I almost wasn't going to talk about it, but it obviously is a major issue. 2430 proposes that if the commercial component exceeds 20%, then the prevailing wage law would apply only to that portion of the project. The whole concept of mixed schedules is a problem that is about to be addressed by BOLI. It's been put on the agenda for an upcoming meeting. Recently, BOLI, January this year, BOLI allowed a project to proceed with mixed rates, commercial rates for the first floor and residential rates for the next residential floors. The general contractor who put it out to bid to subs stated in the bid specs, here's what is to be excluded from the first floor commercial rates and will be subject to the residential rates. And I would suggest what a contractor can do with the mixed-use schedule under the affordable housing exemption, where it must comply with the prevailing wage law for the commercial portion on the first floor, but not the remainder. It says, any conveyance component of mechanical, electrical, and I'm going to provide this to you, any conveyance component of mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and fire sprinkler systems that span more than one floor, such as ductwork, conduit, and wiring, and piping, are excluded. Components that support or produce the conveyance of such systems include, but are not limited to, pumps, switchgear, and load centers are excluded. First floor attached items such as diffusers, faceplates, and toilets are included. So, what's switchgear? Switchgear are those big electrical panels that you see, that there's an electrical room, big electrical panels. Well, because they're connected by wires to the second, third, and fourth floor, they are excluded. Now, I intend to, and I hope that I can argue to the Bureau of Labor and Industries that that violates the law. My point is, it is an opportunity for employers to cheat. The Bureau of Labor currently has an administrative rule that allows for mixed-use projects. This is the result of one of those determinations. You'll have to ask the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division, who's here today, but it is my understanding they have only issued five or six of these determinations, and that is one of the reasons why it's on the agenda of the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee. The prevailing wage law is remedial legislation. It is designed to protect worker wages. Moreover, you know, it's 50 years old now. Originally, we talked about protecting the wages of the community to avoid the importation of cheap labor, but over the last 20 years, 25 years, what I've heard legislators say, what I've heard commissioners of labor say, is that the purpose of the law is that as a matter of public policy, we want competition to be based on ramp-up, supply acquisition, efficiency of operations, overhead, and profit, and not on who can pay the cheapest wages. Why would we want to deviate from what we have now? Why are we going to pass a law that has as its only objective paying workers less wages?
Stop right there, Mr. Malbin. We're not going to pass this legislation as it's written. And we're not going to pass a law that is intended just to get the lowest wages. I just want to assure you that that's not going to happen. And yes, you did not have the benefit of being involved in the work group or the committee hearings last session. And unfortunately, you did not have the benefit of being involved in the work group where Cliff Davis, the head of Local 48, did attend and is participating and trying to find a solution to the language we can all live with. So you're saying a lot of things that just simply are not going to happen. I just wanted to share that with you for your benefit. And I'm going to give you 3 minutes to wrap up, and then Ms. Harris is going to speak.
I'm done.
Thank you. Ms. Harris, please go ahead.
Okay, I will try and keep my comments concise because I know we're short on time. My name is Cherry Harris. I'm a community organizer and business rep for the Operating Engineers, Local 701. First, I wanted to say that I was aware I wasn't involved and at the table in the drafting of House Bill 2140 in 2007. However, I was involved in the conversations that led up to going to BOLI to see if we couldn't come up with a fix. And here's the reason why. I had been working with other of my fellow folks in organized labor to try and work with the Urban Renewal Agency, because it seemed like we were constantly pitted against the affordable housing community in order to make sure that prevailing wage rates did not apply on public-private projects. So in other words, they're publicly funded projects that are privately owned. We've been fighting that for 2 years. You know, I kind of look at it as we all pay taxes. Those dollars become public dollars. There are strings attached to those dollars. And just because you give them to an urban renewal agency that invests them in a public-private project doesn't make them not public dollars. So, anyway, all of those projects, none of those projects had been prevailed through, specifically through the Portland Development Commission. And so that was a major problem. And every time we would come out to bring that to their attention, that there needed to be prevailing wage rate requirements on those jobs, they would make sure that they packed the room with affordable housing developers who would be in there crying about how they weren't going to have any affordable housing built. Finally, Don Kuhl from the Plumbers and I said, this has got to stop. So we set about to develop a relationship with the affordable housing developers. And Michael Anderson is the first person we spoke to, and Michael and I are still friends. We still talk occasionally. So we are not against affordable housing being built, not in any way, shape, or form. In fact, out of those conversations came a premise that all those projects, the bottom line is they all ought to be prevailed. Now, what they raised for us was, we have projects where we're trying to serve the very poorest of the poor. We have trouble getting those projects to pencil out. We said, okay, we hear you. How can we work together to get to a solution? We don't want that to happen, but we also realize that people get out of poverty not just because they can find a roof over, put a roof over their head for a low dollar amount. They also get out of poverty because they're making real family-supportive wages with benefits, with health care. And so we thought, you know, we've got some things in common here. We want to see people get out of poverty as well. We want less need for affordable housing, frankly. So how can we find our way to the middle? And that's what those conversations were about. We came in the current bill that came out of 2140, you will see a reference to a 60% line. And where that came from in our discussions was that it, right now in this current draft, it, that looks like it's being changed to 60% of the affordable housing units. That was not what our discussion was about. Our discussion was about, you know, sometimes we need to house services in those buildings that serve the people who live in those buildings. We want to take that into account, so we don't want that having to fall under this very, very low criteria. And we said, okay, that's, you know, we can probably live with that. Here's the other thing. Oftentimes, they can't afford to put a kitchen in every one of these units, so they have common kitchens. They have hallways that are common areas. So we said, let's exclude that stuff and say 60% of this building has to be targeted for the very poorest of the poor. So that is the recommendation that went to Boley. Here's where we said, we can live with this concept. Can you figure out what's doable under the current law? And if it's not doable under the current law, help us get to a point where we can help accommodate both sides. That's where 2140 came from. And so to think that when I look at the language as it sits on 2430, I have some major objections because it does not get to the heart of what our conversations were about, and I don't think it fixes anything. I'm going to use that term bright line. Because that was the heart of the conversation, was we have got to find a bright line. What the housing developers complained about was they didn't want to think that they had a job that was not covered under prevailing wage law, and then after they start digging the hole in the ground, find out from the backside and get the penalty that, oh my gosh, were we off base? Now all of a sudden the labor commissioner has decided this is a prevailed job. We didn't plan on that. Where are we going to find the extra money? So we said, we understand your problem. So we think 2140 gave a very bright line, and 2430 only muddies the waters and does not accomplish what we tried to accomplish. Thank you.
I couldn't agree more with what you just said. It does not accomplish what we're trying to accomplish. Apparently, one person's bright line is another person's hazy fog.
I would agree.
We definitely don't want the scenario that you just spelled out happening in this state, where the financing's there, the agreement's there, the developer's there, got the backhoe out there digging up a hole, got workers out there, and then all of a sudden, oh, we're going to slap prevailing on the whole thing, or well, pardon the thing that you didn't intend it to. Any questions of these good people? All right, and I share your concerns. They're duly noted, and I can assure you, once again, this committee, and I can promise you, this committee will never pass, as long as I sit here at this chair, ever pass any legislation that is going to just try and get the cheapest, lowest wages or benefits or horrible working conditions for workers. It will never happen. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming, and I look forward to hearing from you when we have the amended version. Okay. With that, I'm going to call David Barenberg and Bob Shiprack. And David, would you go first, please? And then anyone else want to testify to this bill, let me know, because we're going to finish after Mr. Shiprack, unless there's someone else. David, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland. I will be very brief. Since I can't say the word, my whole testimony was based on around it. But essentially, we support the efforts to try to find common language to be able to allow projects to move forward with very clear direction, and really it's very necessary in terms of supporting the development of affordable housing, which is a priority of the city. The issue of having retail on first floors is one that is often driven by city regulation, wanting to ensure that there is safety and visibility and other things, especially in a city environment. So oftentimes projects are responding to local regulation and designing the projects in the manner in which they're designing projects. So with that, I'd like to say we support the efforts of the work group and appreciate the chair in bringing people together. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, David. We do bring people together here to solve problems, not throw insults and talk about things that are never going to happen, because it's just not productive in this committee room. That is not productive. Mr. Shiprack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon State Building Trades Council. I'm going to be very brief because a lot of what I was going to say has already been said. There's a couple of things I just wanted to point out to the committee. And Ms. Harris is absolutely correct. The reason we're here and why we passed the bill last session was based upon the fact that a lot of public funds were going into these public-private partnerships with no recognition of prevailing wage. And I'm talking heavy public subsidies. The bill that passed last session did two things. It does clarify if you got a straight residential affordable housing project, it's very clear that it's exempt where you don't have the mixed-use issue. On commercial projects where you don't have residential involved, it's perfectly clear now. We do have that line. But in the city of Portland, where they track this, well over approximately $100 million of projects have now been prevailed that never were before. So one of the things that a misconception out there that I want to just make sure the committee understands is you didn't have it before. The House Bill 2140 from last session did clarify it in some areas. But now we've got this one little narrow issue of mixed use, and Michael Anderson described how many projects, very few. It was intended
in the bill last session to be addressed. I still maintain it was, but a very arcane reading of that statute, and I've even had legislative counsel look at it, and they struggled to see it, but in fact, at the end of the day, I must admit, they said you could probably get there that the bill was not drafted properly. In effect, that we limited the mixed use to residential. We didn't say mixed use the right way. And hopefully the attorneys will get it right this time. That's all I wanted to say. You're adding prevailing wage to these projects. You're not taking it away. Please get that right. And that was based upon an agreement between us and the housing people and the contractors and the Portland Development Commission, the City of Portland, that in fact, when you're putting millions of dollars of public funds into projects, with that comes a recognition that there should be labor standards attached.
Any questions of these good gentlemen? Representative Edwards.
I'd just like to compliment the last two folks for the concise nature of their testimony.
Thank you very much. All right, any further questions or comments of these guys?
Mr. Chair? Yes. I just want to follow up on Representative Thatcher's question. In looking at the background materials, what you would normally look at, the history for House Bill 2104, there's not enough information, so I will provide you, and I will forward to the rest of the committee some detailed information on the synopsis of House Bill 2140 pertinence to this bill. So I'll let you know that.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Anyone else want to testify today?
All right, then we're going to close the hearing. And anything for good of the order,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cameron, please.
Maybe recognize, it looks like our 4-H students that are here visiting today and understanding totally about prevailing wage by now, right?
And what an easy,
that'll never happen.
What an easy subject matter it is. Thank you for coming. Enjoy your capital.
Yeah, thank you.
We adjourn.